This year, you were right at the point of 60. Counting up, there weren't many days till your birthday. But you didn't even stay in the human world for two more months. For 40 years, maintaining the household with your bare hands. Now that you've died, it will be hard to be like the past. Two white-haired people of 60 part forever. I expect my life will not last long. That's from the poem cycle, 100 Sorrows, from 19th century Chinese poet Yu Yue. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Through a fascinating study of five generations of a famous Chinese family, ranging from imperial to modern China, my guest this hour sheds light on a history and culture many of us know virtually nothing about. Why did Chinese families sometimes write poems about the dead and then bury those poems? Why did Chinese women sometimes burn their writings and leave men in charge of recovering their stories? My guest this hour is Rania Huntington, professor of Chinese in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and the author most recently of Ink and Tears, Memory, Mourning, and Writing in the Yu Family. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I'm always interested to find out what draws someone to a particular field or topic. Tell me about what drew you. You're from Wisconsin,
yes.
Not Chinese. What no. drew you to the study of Chinese literature from another time? It is something that's very distant from the Wisconsin you grew up in.
Well, I think the distance was a lot of what attracted me. Yes, I grew up in Mesomeni. And I was fascinated by foreign languages from a very young age. And I took German in high school because it was the only foreign language offered by Wisconsin Heights High School at that particular time. And I loved it. But it sometimes didn't feel very foreign to me. So with there's so many cognates with English. So I was determined to try to learn a language that felt really foreign. And like many people who don't study Chinese, I was fascinated by Chinese characters. And there was a pivotal moment in deciding to study Chinese, which also makes a good story. My father was at a professional conference in Oxford. And while he was at his professional conference, he was trying to figure out, I went with him on this trip, and he needed to figure out something for me to do. And I had a research project that I was doing that went beyond what certainly the library at my high school could offer. And there was a particular book that even the University of Wisconsin-Madison library didn't have an English translation. So normally a high school student wouldn't be allowed in the Bodleian Library of Oxford. I mean, that's, you don't have the status for that. But when we went to the office and explained that I had an actual research task, there was a book I needed that isn't available in my local libraries, they granted me a day's reader's pass. So yeah, I'm 16 years old, and I'm standing in the Oriental Studies reading room of the Bodleian Library of Oxford. And I've looked it up in the catalog, and I have the information for the book I need. And I'm standing very timidly in front of the librarian, who I remember as a stern and formidable looking middle-aged Chinese woman, saying, this is the book I need. It wasn't OpenStax. This is the book I need. And I need the English translation. And she looked at me and said, "You don't read Chinese?" And I was struck. I was overcome with shame. And had to say, I don't read Chinese. But then I thought, I'm a 16-year-old white girl from Mesomeni, Wisconsin. And she asked it as a question. She thinks maybe I could. And that's the moment I decided, I'm going to read Chinese someday. So I started trying to teach myself from a book. But I didn't, really start studying till college. And in the same period, I also started reading a lot of translated novels while I was riding the school bus. So rural Wisconsin, I had a long, circuitous route to school. That's when I had my heart set on Chinese literature.
That's amazing. And with your attempt to learn Chinese, was it harder than you expected? And was that a journey that and how did it change you? Because it always has struck me that when you learn a language, you also open up different parts of your mind and think about the world in new ways.
I don't know if I can remember who I was before Chinese that well already, right? Because, you know, it's been, you know, so I've really started studying since I was 18 and it's taken up most of my brain space since then. Harder than I realized, yes. Chinese, as many people know, is a tonal language. And in terms of singing and music, I'm effectively tone deaf. I'm not truly tone deaf. I can hear melodies and I remember them. But I really can't carry a tune when I sing. You know, and I was told by childhood choir teachers to please sing a little more quietly because mine was not the voice you wanted belting out. And so when I first tried to learn the tones of Chinese, my freshman year and first semester Chinese, I couldn't hear them. I couldn't reproduce them. To my frustration, to my teacher's frustration, the way I dealt with this was spending an incredible amount of time in the language lab. This was back in the day when studying a foreign language, you went to a certain room where they had cassette tapes and you could listen to the, you know, to these tapes. And I went to the language lab as soon as it opened in the morning and just spent hours there. And the consequence was that I memorized all the dialogues. I still couldn't hear the tones, but I'd memorize all the dialogues and I'd get the tones right on the quizzes because I'd memorized it, not because I knew could hear it. And, you know, characters, people always think, oh, the characters, that's impossible. The characters are challenging, but that was something that if you spend I was always confident if you spend the time, I will remember. And I could do that. So, but the tones felt like such an obstacle. And I felt like, what on earth am I going to do? I've fallen in love with this language and I can't speak it. I can't hear it. I can't speak it. What am I going to do? But, you know, they came slowly. There's the dirty secret that the longer your utterances are, the more native speakers will correct for your bad tones and be like, oh, okay. They've got to mean this. Oh, it must be this. So the longer and more complicated your sentences are, you know, you still have a bad accent, but people can understand what you're saying. As opposed to a few words in translation, words in isolation. And then I lived in Taiwan for a summer between my freshman and sophomore years of college. And then I lived in China for a year, my junior year. And, you know, sometime, and I didn't even know when it happened, I started hearing tones and I started being able to say tones. I mean, I don't have a flawless accent. It's really good sometimes, or not really good, it's fairly good sometimes. And sometimes I hear it going, ooh, that went off key, just like I'm sure someone who can actually sing can tell if they say, if they go off key. But I can certainly hear them now. And yeah. How did it change me?
How did it change you? Because I think sometimes there are words in one language that are untranslatable.
Absolutely.
There are some languages that don't have any word for a certain thing. And so the cultural beliefs are sort of embedded in the language.
Well, here I teach classical Chinese, roughly speaking, classical Chinese is to modern Chinese as Latin is to modern Italian. Right? So, my students and I, we were discussing this issue on a regular basis, and I always tell them, if you find a word that you can't just translate and you have to use a couple sentences to explain, you probably have a great research topic. There's probably, you know, cultural volumes in that word. Yes, there's many of those things. So how am I different in Chinese? Well, in speaking Chinese, in modern Chinese, my Chinese-speaking persona is more aggressive and less shy than my English-speaking persona. I mean, my husband would joke about it when we would travel in China, you know, sometimes he'd say, you know, I think we need Miss Han to come out and deal with this situation. And I think it's partially just because I had to do things like ask for directions and ask what was going on and talk to strangers in ways I usually don't have to here. I think classical Chinese and reading, I think the ways that's changed my patterns of thought probably go a lot deeper. I think there are I think there's certain concepts about destiny and what people owe to other people and what it means to understand other people that, you know, the classical Chinese terms have gone very deep.
I found myself when I read your book, Ink and Tears, struck with my own inadequacies in the sense that you have poems included with the English and then next to it are the Chinese characters. And unlike a situation where I might be reading something and it would show the French and English or German and English, I get nothing from the Chinese characters other than that they look so beautiful. But I would think translating poetry, which is always tough in any language where you're dealing with sound and certain words, but to translate from English, from Chinese into English, must have been extremely difficult. I'm also curious about if you could talk about what drew you to the topic of your most recent book, Ink and Tears, Memory, Mourning, and Writing in the Yu Family. What drew you to a study of the Yu family?
Well, it's a convoluted path. My first book was about shape-shifting fox spirits, which are a popular topic of Chinese legend. And in researching that book, I read a lot of these small collections of miscellaneous stories. And as I was just looking for stories about fox spirits, so, you know, wouldn't matter if a collection of stories was famous or not famous, if it was from a certain time period, I would page through it looking for foxes. And so I read the collection by Yu Ye, man at the center of this book, and I liked it. It had some fox stories in it. None of them were particularly extraordinary, but I just kind of had a sense of, oh, yeah, I like that. I like the style. I like the flavor of that. And his book had gotten me interested in another article-length project, as I noticed in his little is stories about the supernatural are never just about the supernatural. I mean, people talk about ghosts and monsters as a way to think about the things that are too frightening or too desirable or too difficult to talk about in any other way. So I noticed that he had a lot of stories about the aftermath of the Taiping Rebellion, which was this devastating civil war in mid-19th century China. And so I was doing an article about how that civil war was remembered in these little strange stories and anecdotes. So I was working on this article at a difficult point in my personal life. So in the year 2001, I suffered an early miscarriage, and just about at the point when I thought I might be trying to get pregnant again, I discovered I had breast cancer that was fairly advanced. Breast cancer, it had spread to lymph nodes, hadn't metastasized anywhere else. I was 33, so I really hadn't been expecting this. And in the midst of cancer treatment, I fell into a depression. And to this day, well, actually, a brief, a spectacular episode of mania followed by a depression. And to this day, I don't know if this was a drastic chemotherapy side effect to some extent or if it was just a result of my failing to cope, which I really thought I could just, because I was an ambitious tenure-track professor, and I really thought I could keep doing everything while being treated for cancer. I can keep teaching. I can keep doing my research. I can keep doing everything while I'm being treated for cancer.
And coping with grief.
And coping with my grief for my miscarriage and my grief for the life I didn't, for everything I thought I was going to have and didn't, right? So I fell into depression, and I was still trying to read. I was still trying to do work. And one of the things I was still trying to do was I had checked out a copy of Yu Ye's little volume of strange stories, and Youtai Xianguan Biji, a collection, jotting notes from the Youtai Transcendence abode at Mount Youtai. And I would be trying to read it while I was lying, and I was incredibly fatigued between depression and chemotherapy. And I would be trying to read it. And classical Chinese is traditionally printed without punctuation. It's part of being literate that you just read along and you're like, oh, that's where the sense ends. And you just do this in your mind. And I had gotten to the point, I was pretty good at that, particularly at stories, the kinds of stories I read all the time. But in my fatigue and my depression, I couldn't do it anymore. This was an unpunctuated old style edition of his works, and I could not punctuate the sentences. So I would read the same passage, which made no sense because I couldn't break the sentences, over and over and over, and without stopping because I couldn't break the sentences. And it felt like, you know, the absolute low point. It's like, you know, I worked so hard to learn Chinese, to learn classical Chinese, to learn to read classical Chinese, and I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. I can't. And, you know, but that's depression, right? That's the story depression tells you, is this is the way it's always going to be. But, you know, long story made short, you know, I did the depression, you know, the depression did break with the help of medication and some really supportive friends and family. And I got back to work. And I discovered later that, oh, I read that and yeah, the sentences end again. Why was this ever hard? This is clear. And I had just read his book as, you know, one collection of weird tales among many. I never really thought about him, what the context was for him writing it. But one day I don't even remember why, I decided I'd read his preface. And he starts out saying, oh, the Yotai Transcendence Abode. This is the little house he built for himself, the cottage he built for himself next to his wife's grave. And he said, well, after she died, I couldn't do serious work. Because you called him a poet in the introduction, and he wrote a lot of poetry. But what he was really known for was he was a scholar. Mm-hmm. He was a scholar of the Confucian classics. So when he says serious work, that's what he means. He means annotations of the classics or teaching his students about the classics. And he said, I couldn't do serious work anymore. I was grieving. You know, so I decided, but it's such a habit of my life to write. I still wanted to write. So I started to collect these weird stories from all my friends and family. And I realized, oh, you know, this book that kept me company when I was at my lowest moment, he wrote it when he was grieving.
That's pretty remarkable, that sense of connection then.
Yeah. And I wondered, well, I wonder if he wrote anything else about his wife, you know, or if this is the only place. And then I looked and discovered, oh, he wrote so much for her, for his daughter.
And some of the customs that you write about in the book in terms of burying poems or...
Well, actually, it's burning them more than burying. He buries his books at one point, but that's like all of his books. It's burning things that is more important. Because that was viewed as a way to send something over into the next world.
Well, let me have you back it up before. I know we've got five generations of the Yu family and so on, but can you just place this, the first one, Yu, and you pronounce the second name Yu Wei?
Yeah.
So he's born in what year, and what was the China he was born into like?
He's born in 1821, and the China he was born into. People simplifying the story of Chinese history will call the 18th century, so the world before he was born, China's traditional imperial China's last great golden age. It was a height of imperial expansion. China viewed itself as the center of its political and economic world. It was a point of great cultural flowering. But toward the end of the 18th century, there's already rumblings. And the world into which he was born was one where those rumblings are getting much closer. He was a young man at the time of the Opium War, where there's a realization on China's part of having to deal with the Western powers. He was a he was in his 30s when the Taiping Rebellion, the Civil War I mentioned, breaks out and stress tears it apart.
And remind me of the circumstances of the Taiping Rebellion.
Well, the Taiping Rebellion was begun in the southern part of China by a group of rebels who actually had some ideas loosely derived from Christianity in some parts. They believed in a single God, but that their leader was a younger brother of Jesus Christ. And that the Manchus, who were ruling China, this is a non-Han Chinese ethnic minority who had conquered China in the middle of the 17th century, were demons that needed to be driven out. And all the gods that the Chinese worshipped were demons, and their temples should be destroyed. Their ideas had egalitarian aspects, too, opposing the foot binding, the binding of women's feet. And... giving a voice to a lot of people's economic discontent and some brilliant strategy, they managed to rise from a small band of rebels to take over a large part of China and turn in, including the prosperous cities of the Yangtze River Valley. The Civil War goes on for 10 years. And the Qing government does finally succeed in quashing the rebels, partially in part because of infighting on the part of the rebels. But the loss of life is vast.
And would you have been considered a Confucian, a Buddhist, a Taoist?
A Confucian first and foremost. He is of... So if you wish to become part of China's ruling elite, you did that by spending your life studying to pass a series of highly competitive exams that were based on your knowledge of the Confucian classics. And China had a great growth in the population overall and of the literate population without a great expansion in the number of government positions that were available. So it was incredibly competitive to try to pass all these levels of the exam. And Yu Ye is one of the talented and lucky few who made it all the way to the top. He passed the highest level of the civil service exam and was all set up for what one would presume would be a prospering career in government. But then he was dismissed from office for some irregularities in the exam questions he produced when he was an examiner for one of these exams. Dismissed from office, told he could never serve again. And so he reinvents himself instead as a teacher of the Confucian classics. So he would identify himself as a Confucian first and foremost. However, these are not mutually exclusive identities in the China, in China in any time, but in the China of his world. So he also, Confucian first and foremost, but he also has interest in both Taoist and Buddhist texts and writes notes about them. I mean, this is what sets him apart as a scholar is he really would read anything and would look at in some of the unlikeliest places for correlations to figure out things that were going on in the classics. But he would put the Confucian classics at the heart as the most important part of his life and work and belief system.
You open your book with him burying one of his teeth along with the tooth of his wife. We're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Rania Huntington, and we are talking about five generations of a Chinese family and their beliefs about writing, about memory, about loss. You open your book, Ink and Tears, with an introduction entitled A Grave for Teeth, A Grave for Books. Can you talk about, first of all, why you started the book this way and what the teeth have to do with anything?
Right. Well, one of the things that Yuya does after his wife of many years dies is that she had lost a tooth in her relatively advanced years, and her family kept it, and I'm not quite sure why they had held on to it. But when one of Yuya's own teeth falls out, he gives the two teeth side by side a miniature burial. Marks the spot and writes a poem about burying husband and wife's teeth together, obviously with the two teeth standing in as miniatures for themselves. Yuya and his wife were cousins. Cousin marriage was not uncommon as long as you were marrying a cousin of a different last name. You couldn't marry your father's brother's children, but your father's sister's children or your mother's siblings' children were all acceptable marriage partners in some parts of China, preferred marriage partners. So they were cousins. They had known each other as childhood, married in their teens, and then had spent a lifetime together, sometimes apart, but a lifetime in marriage, and particularly happy in the last decades of her life. And so when she dies, he writes a great deal about her. And he always is saying things like, it won't be long till I get to sleep beside you. Because he really was assuming, they were close to the same age. He was assuming that, well, I'm not long for this world. But, she died in 1879, and he lives on till 1905. So he has a much longer time ahead of him as a widower than he thinks. And the book Grave is something else that he decides to do, to take his complete works and give it a burial, give it a grave. And so it got me thinking about what writing and ritual of burial meant for this family and how words are so important to the process of memory for them.
You talk also about how the poem that he wrote about the teeth gets picked up in Japan.
Yes. Well, again, he was a scholar of the classics, and he was quite well known for this in Japan, had Japanese acquaintances, some of them who, would claim sort of a disciple relationship. And yes, his poem about the tooth grave gets transmitted to Japan, and his Japanese acquaintances also think that this is just a remarkable story, right? The old Confucian master burying his wife's tooth and writing poems about it and making a tooth grave. And so it shows that Yuya is very well known at his time. He's a very famous scholar. He can publish anything he writes, no matter how important or unimportant, how serious or how personal. And so for him, it's not just about writing as a process of mourning in some sort of private sense, private therapeutic sense. Writing is published. It's a public act of mourning. And he is making his mourning for his wife a part of his public persona.
And according to the beliefs that he would have had at the time of his wife's death, where did he think she was? In other words, did he believe that she was in some netherworld, that she would be in any way reincarnated, that she would somehow be present. I noticed quite a few poems also in writings that have to do with dreams.
Yeah.
But what were his beliefs? Because death in any culture, death is at testing ground in terms of what people believe.
Well, I mean, he was, more broadly, he was in a society that had mixed beliefs about this. Making offerings to ancestors is a crucial part of Confucian family ritual. And there is a belief that the ancestors actually do come back and enjoy those sacrifices. Perhaps not super clear where they are between the times for enjoying sacrifices, but believing that they are somewhere in an afterlife. Reincarnation was also a common belief in his world. He doesn't talk about that with reference to his own family members. So as expressed in his writings for and about him, he pictures his wife in another world where, when he burns them, she can still get his letters and his poems, and he still tells her family news in these about, how things are developing in the family. So he imagines her in a space where she still cares about these things. And yes, there is, and I did one piece of this book I wrote separately as an article about Dreams of the Dead, which strangely enough is only published in French, translated by someone else, and I don't write or read French, but anyway. So there was a belief, as in many cultures, that dreams are a state in which beings from other orders of reality can talk to you, including that the souls of the dead will come to visit the living in dreams. And this is actually a point on which he's quite frustrated, because he doesn't dream of her coming back to visit her nearly as much, but he does have one really memorable dream. So he dreams that the two of them are together in a small place, and there's an inscription on it in his handwriting saying the realm of warmth and love. And the wind is howling outside, but they're in this small, warm place together. And they wake up, and in a letter that he writes to her and burns so that she can receive it, he's asking her, so where was that place, right? Is that the afterlife? Is that what the world in the grave is? Is this realm of warmth and love where you and I can be together? But generally, he's frustrated that he doesn't dream of her as much as he would want to. And in his collection of weird stories, he has one little story about, just frustrated that she doesn't come to him in dreams. But there is one night where he's staying awake at night and there's a mosquito that's really bothering him and keeping him from sleeping. And he's getting so upset about, in that insomniac grouchiness of like, I'm already so old and sick and now there's this mosquito and I'm not getting any sleep and I'm going to be a mess tomorrow. And not exactly these words, but this is the sense of it. And then suddenly it's as if the mosquito was slapped by an unseen force. He's like, oh, that was you. He thinks it's his wife's spirit who was slapped the mosquito, which is a glimpse of, well, maybe she was the one who did that when they were alive, that she would wake up soon. But thinking, oh, that was you.
I think things like that are what makes reading the book very poignant, that sense of someone who's grieving and is trying to find connection with someone that they've lost. Even the title that you chose, Ink and Tears, and the idea that someone is kind of present still on papers they might have written. Can you talk a little bit about the title, Ink and Tears?
Well, I think that was what it was. So for the generations of this family, this is, these were the two forms that mourning took. There was weeping and there was ink. And the difference being that, you know, the ink could be transmitted and passed down, and to keep the memory of the one that you were weeping for. I think the image Ink and Tears comes up particularly strongly if we go a couple generations forward, if we go to Yuya's grandson. So I had written an article about Yuya and his wife, and I thought I was done with writing about their family. I thought, oh, you know, that was very absorbing, you know, but I'm done with that. I think I'll, you know, I can go and work on other things. And I was in the library in Nanjing, and Nanjing is a very hot and humid city in the summer. And I had another unrelated research project on 17th century literature going on, and I had some books that I wanted to, rare books I wanted to see for that project. And the librarians declared that, you know, when it's above a certain temperature and humidity level, you are not allowed to look at any books that are earlier than, I think, 1780.
You know, because of the sweat on
your fingers? Because of the preservation, yeah. Right? Because of the humidity of the air, mm-hmm. the climate control, sweat on your fingers. It's like, no, you can't see the older things. And then I was like, oh, well, there goes my research plan. What am I going to do here in the library? And I thought, well, you know, the Yu family, they're always writing something. Why don't I just look and see if there's anything else? And I found this little book by Yuya's grandson, Yu Biyun. And in Chinese tradition, the family name is first, personal name second. And this was also written for his wife. Now, one of the things that a man could do mourning for a woman is if that woman was a poet, even if her work was never published in her lifetime, he could collect all of her poetry and publish it. Yuya had done this for one of his daughters. But Yu Biyun's problem was that his wife hadn't been a poet, but she had been a calligrapher, a very skilled calligrapher. And so he starts collecting every scrap of paper that she wrote on, no matter what it was. You know, reminders to do something, shopping lists, drafts of letters, all of these scraps he collects, and then he writes a poem about each one of the scraps. So he has a little introduction saying this is what the scrap was, and then a poem about each of the scraps. And then puts not the scraps of her writing, but his poems about the scraps together in this small collection of poetry. So there the Ink and Tears was very literal. And he was looking for any traces of her handwriting and her ink.
Also, I think some of the descriptions make it clear that they feel the presence of the person still, that there's something a little bit almost sacred in the ink itself, that,
yes,
that something remains.
Well, the term, the other term that's in there, there's a term, shouzi, which is like the moisture from the hands. And there's an idea that in the writing of the deceased people, it's like the touch of their hands, and the moisture of their hands is still there. So there is still that presence. And so that was what Biyun was trying to capture as he collected up all the scraps that his wife had written.
Can you say something about the position of women in general, first back with the grandfather at his time with the wife that he lost, but then just in general? You know, you had mentioned with the rebellion, kind of a rebellion against the bound feet. You know, to what extent were women in the Yu family allowed to express themselves in free ways?
Well, I mean, they were a very traditional family in terms of gender roles, it would have to be said. So the traditional division is that women are on the inside of the house, men are on the outside. And the women, the women of the family were highly educated, and that had become in elite families, particularly in their region of China, that had become fairly common that the women also be educated. The initial reasoning for this was that educated mothers would raise educated sons. And so that still the emphasis was on the sons and their careers. But also, you know, educated women could be parts of the intellectual lives of their very bookish husbands and sons and fathers, particularly when it comes to poetry. Chinese poetry is a very social art. Many poems are written on occasions for particular people, and you answer back by writing another poem in exchange. So the women of the Yu family, Yu Ye's wife, Wen Yu, if she had written poems and had written poems back and forth to Yu Ye, commenting on very important things in his life, right? Commenting when he passed the exam, commenting when he was dismissed from office. But for a while, she had kept her poems together in a collection. But then she burned them.
Well, that surprises me, the burning of writing, especially if there's no copy or was a copy left behind.
She had burned them once, and then while she's alive, and Yu Ye managed to reconstruct them and produced a nice little copy that she really liked, she burns them again, and there was not a copy. So this is the burning of writing. Yu Ye's wife does this, and later his favorite daughter does this before she dies. And there are other women in the family's history who also do this. And this is one of the acts that's kind of a central question in this text. Why are they burning their writing? There is a literary model. The heroine of the great 18th century Chinese novel, The Dream of the Red Chamber, when she knows that her life is about to end, burns the manuscripts of all her poems. For the motives of the individual women, some of it is seen, again, none of them left anything in writing saying this is why I burned mm-hmm. my poems, because that in some ways is contradictory.
Right.
There seems to be an element of renunciation of the world. Goodbye to all of that. There could be some modesty because, the women, it's striking in this family that until one of the women who's quite late in the story, none of these women have their poetry published while they're alive. Now, there are other, and this is not necessarily the case for women in their society. There are anthologies of women's poets. There are women who become famous as poets while they're alive. But there's still a lot of people also like the use that the poems don't get published until after the women are dead as an act of memory by husbands, sons, or grandsons. It is so. There could be some reluctance in the women's part that these poems were part of a living social exchange in their families, not meant for publication. And to burn them to avoid that, a sense of modesty, to keep themselves sequestered in the women's quarters, to deny the men the chance to publish them.
Could it be sort of like with Emily Dickinson, where she discovered publication meant editors that changed punctuation, added titles she didn't choose, changed words?
Well,
could there have been a sense of control? If you burn your writing, no one's going to alter it or censor
it. I think certainly there's a sense of control. I don't know if it was directly the fear of editors messing with it, but if it's published and circulates, you don't have control over who reads it and who gets it and what they do with it. And I think there was a sense there was more at stake with your reputation for a woman than a man if your writing was going around and anyone could do anything with it. But the end of it is that we don't really know. Once his wife does it, then, well, maybe his daughter is doing it because her mother did it, right? It's hard. But it raises a difficult question about complicity on the men's part, because the men, and this even starts a generation earlier, this starts with the generation of Yu Ye's father, who only appears in the prologue, who has a wife who he's only married to for a very brief time before she dies, and he knows she was a poet, and after she dies he goes looking for her poetry and there's none of it. She's eliminated all of it. you know, it, especially in the case of his daughter, you know, why did Yuya not think, there's a risk of this, I should keep a clean copy of her work, right? Why, you know, why did he not put the same value on preservation and transmission of her work while she was alive and when she was dead? So I think there's, you know, it raises a question.
It certainly does. We're going to listen to a little of the grandson's poetry read in Chinese as well as in English when we return in a moment with the University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Rania Huntington, and we are talking about Ink and Tears, exploring five generations of a famous Chinese family. The grandson that we were talking about, can you give us a sample of his poetry? And I'm just kind of longing to hear it in the original Chinese as well as in English.
All right. Well, and my voice is not as melodic as someone who could absolutely recite it.
自离边城即是珠 在省弄带会跟我,了人生有红银在,有学房言离离乎.
And that's words compiled to become pearls of remembrance. Will they be able to carry roots of intelligence into the next life? Most distressing is the red parrot left behind, still imitating dialect, calling and lisping. And this, the scrap that he wrote this about, is 43 miscellaneous characters. And here's his introduction explaining what it was. You had forgotten many of the books you had read when young, so you often asked me to write down those characters easiest to forget to teach you, and would make your own notations about pronunciation with characters of similar sound on the side. The pronunciations of Wu dialect and Chu dialect were always different, so I would often correct you playfully. You also taught Minar Tang poems in a Chu accent. So a lot of things come out in that. First, they're from very different regions of China, this husband and wife. The family has a great tradition of cousin marriage, but they're an exception. Yu Biyun and his husband, Peng Jianzhen, became married because their grandfathers had been great friends. Yuya and the general Peng Yulin had been great friends and decided to betroth their grandchildren. And that's another note, that all of the marriages in this book, the happy ones and the unhappy ones, are all arranged marriages. They're decisions that were made by the families rather than the individuals. So she came from a completely different part of China, modern Hunan province, where they are living in Suzhou in modern Jiangsu province. And their local dialects are different. And so she, and this is an issue that brings up from time to time. So you know, she was literate, but when she became a wife with more household duties, with less time to spend studying, so she was forgetting how to write some words. And so he would try to help her. But Chinese characters, there's not a direct connection between the word and the sound. You need to memorize it. So she was saying, okay, how's this one pronounced? And writing something else that she thought sounded the same to give herself the hint. But what she thought sounded the same and what he thought sounded the same were different because of their different dialects. And that last sentence, you taught Minar Tang poems in a Chu accent, that's one of their daughters. And she's surrounded by people, none of them speak the same dialect that she does. So it's this one piece of home that she can hold on to, is that when she teaches her daughter to recite poetry, to still have her do it in her mother's mm-hmm. home accent.
I like the opening line that you read from his poem. I'm not going to get it right, but it was something about words being pearls of remembrance.
Yes.
you know, that's just a beautiful way to think about words. And it does seem as if whichever generation of this family you're looking at, whichever tragedy of a, you know, daughter that's lost or a wife that's lost or a sister or something, it's this struggle to figure out how to remember and how words can be used to try to remember someone that's that where it's a transient presence, it's gone.
Yes. And yeah, and that's exactly what those first two lines are, right? You know, these words are the pearls of the resemblance, but what about in our next life, right? Are they still going to act as memory in our, if in our next lives, and that's a poem when we are, then they are talking about an idea of reincarnation. Yeah, and the other thing I really like in that one is that often there's a shift in elder texts, in their texts between remembering in a very literal memorizing sense, because this was, you know, first those characters were only copied down to study, to try to remember in that sense. But now that same random bit of notations has become about remembrance and personal remembrance. And that shift happens several times with the ink.
You move a couple generations after this point toward the end of the book in term and talk about even the persecution of, I think it's a great
great-grandson,
who under Mao is, I believe, sentenced to manual labor.
Yeah, this is Yu Pingbo. And in the family's history, the two famous people are Yu Ye and the great-grandson Yu Pingbo. They were, in their respective very different generations, the most famous, or not among the most prominent scholars. Yes, Yu Pingbo gets singled out for criticism, for some of his literary criticism. And then during the Cultural Revolution, he gets sent down to the countryside to do manual labor with the peasants. And even though he's quite old already at the, at that point. And he, and so he also experiences this great loss of his written works, because all of their, all the family's books are confiscated by the Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution. And interestingly enough, some of them, the ones that were, you know, previously published books, get returned to the family. They had been stored. But his own handwritten manuscripts have all been burned and destroyed. So he was a man who was in the situation that earlier it had been men in the family trying to reconstruct the poetry that that women had burned and trying to reconstruct when they was gone. He was a man trying to do that with his own poetry because it had been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution. And at the same time, when he was trying to put together his own works, he also hand copies a manuscript of his own sister's poetry because he had outlived all of his three sisters. So this pattern of the man remembering the woman is continuing into that generation as well.
And even though we're talking about Chinese generations of family at a particular time and place, it does seem as if there's this universal theme that we can relate to, having to do with trying to remember those we love, and also both the power of words and perhaps their vulnerability. They do disappear as well throughout the story. Thank you for illuminating this fascinating period in Chinese history. My guest has been Rania Huntington. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.